Welcome to the Deadcast.
Sunday, June 26, 1994. A Miramar, Florida police officer stands outside the home of one Butch Casey. He's been dispatched to the house after learning that a missing person named Marie Rogers was last known to be in the presence of Casey. He can hear music coming from the house, and although he has pounded on the door numerous times, there is still no response. Acting on a hunch, the officer goes around the side of the house and into the backyard, where he is able to peer through the sliding glass doors that look into the dining room. The sight that lays before him is one that is both disturbing and puzzling. The man, Butch Casey, is lying in a pool of blood, while nearby, the bodies of two females are also lying in pools of blood. He radios into dispatch, telling them of his discovery. And although he doesn't know it, the three bodies lying inside are in fact dead. And this is the start of one of South Florida's most infamous cases, the Casey's Nickelodeon murders. Hello again, and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me this week as we prepare to look at a case that was recommended to me by a friend of mine by the name of Howard Baum a few months back, and I'm just now getting around to covering it. I also like to apologize for getting the show out slightly later than normal this week. There were a few unforeseen circumstances regarding my computer that I had to take care of in order to be able to record this week. Before we dive into it, as always, I have my normal plugs. If you would like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter at AuthorTotten. I am also on Instagram at IanTottenAuthor. You can find me on Facebook at Ian Totten Author, and there is a Deathcast group that is associated with that page that you can join. If you'd like to help support the show production-wise, I have a Patreon channel under Ian Totten Author. There's a number of tiers on there. One of them starts off, it's just general support. Another one above that, you can join and you'll be getting exclusive content as I create it, such as exclusive episodes of the Deathcast. You can also find me on Venmo and PayPal at Ian Totten. That's a way to send a one-time donation to the show. My book of the week this week is the 25th anniversary edition of Haunted by best-selling author Tamara Thorne. I've actually spoken with Tamara about this book, and it's just about to be released. So if you're into gripping horror from someone who has been called the Stephen King of the horror genre, I can't recommend Haunted enough. Again, that's the 25th anniversary edition of Haunted by Tamara Thorne. You can find it on Amazon and Kindle. All right, now that the plugs are out of the way, let's sit back and relax. Get yourself something to drink, close your eyes, tune out the world. I've got my cigarettes and I've got my coffee. Let's go into the crypt. As I said in the preview for the show, this week we're going to be looking at the Casey's Nickelodeon murders that took place in Miramar, Florida in 1994. Going into this case, I really knew nothing about it other than what a quick Google search had told me. And given the infamy that this case has in South Florida, as well as the brutality of the crimes, I'm fairly surprised that it's not a more well-known case. it's pretty much what you have is the police in Miramar, they cordon off the entire neighborhood. It's a fairly upper class neighborhood. Casey was known to be fairly well off. You know, he owned and ran the nightclub that was named after him. But it was what was found inside the house that you really shocked the police. Casey, along with two dancers, Sharon Anderson and Marie Lott Rogers, lay beaten and shot execution style in the head in Casey's living room. And they had no leads at first. They began searching around the house trying to find any evidence that might lead to, you know, an idea of why this happened, what happened. One thing they found was a pair of Casey's boots lying thrown into the living room. Now, Casey was a fairly eccentric individual who was known to keep wads of cash inside of his boots. And when I say known, this was something that was pretty much well known throughout town, so the police understood why the boots were lying there in the kitchen. What they couldn't figure out naturally was why they had been killed or possibly who had done it. So they began looking around the house further, and one of the things they found was a small white cabinet with hundreds of videotapes beneath it, which they quickly discovered were homemade sex tapes Casey had made of himself entertaining various women. Looking further, however, they discovered another camera that had recently been installed in the dining room. And looking back over the tape that was inside the VCR connected to the camera, they were horrified to discover that the entire act, the entire murder and assault of the three victims was actually recorded on tape. And I've actually viewed the tape. You can find it online. And what it shows is Butch Casey standing there in the early morning hours, entertaining his two guests, when suddenly two men rush into the dining room from the sliding glass doors that led in from the outside patio. Casey is standing there 1 minute. One of the girls actually runs out of the room. One of the assailants chases after her, while the other assailant, who is brandishing a gun, rushes over to Casey and pistol whips him in the head before turning around and shoving the other woman, who is sitting in the chair, over. And watching the video, it almost seems as though the woman was unconscious when the chair goes over, because she just flops right over against the wall. Her head kind of bends at an unnatural angle when it happens. The assailant then turns his attention back to Casey, and although there's no sound on the video, it's apparent that he is asking questions of Casey as he begins to pistol whip him on occasion, bludgeoning him with the gun in order to get answers. After a few moments, his friend, who is wearing what looks to be a gray hoodie sweatshirt, comes back into the room, and after talking with the man who is beating on Casey, he begins to look around in the living room, obviously searching for something. And he continues to do this while his friend directs him around the house. And at one point, Casey actually seems to fight back. But he's quickly subdued by the one man, who's wearing a dark shirt and a baseball cap. Eventually, the two of them are standing there over the prone bodies of the woman who had been in the chair and Casey. And the man in the hoodie realizes that he has touched the glass tabletop, So he takes off the bandana that is covering his face, wipes the sweat from his face, and begins to wipe down the tabletop furiously to remove any fingerprints he may have left. After which, he pulls out a gun and shoots both victims in the head. And it was this piece of film footage that the police would use in order to identify a suspect. Again, you can find this footage online. It's pretty grainy. Remember, it's 1994, but the police were smart enough to get both the FBI and NASA involved, and they were able to get a clear enough image of the one perpetrator that they were able to send out his picture over the wire to other nearby police stations. Now, before I get into all of that, I'm going to dive into the victims. Butch Casey was born Casimir Sukaraski Jr. on January 6th of 1946. Now, from everything I could find, Casey had grown up in New York City, and in fact, he had run a bar of the same name as Casey's Nickelodeon in New York up until his parents had sold the bar, at which point he moved to Florida, and he opened up the new Casey's Nickelodeon in 1989. And he quickly established himself as the head of the party scene in the area. He was a very flashy, flamboyant guy, carrying a chrome-plated handgun, wearing cowboy boots that he had stuffed with money, expensive watches, aviator sunglasses and silk scarves. From everything that I have seen, he was into the whole party lifestyle, a lot of booze, a lot of coke, a lot of women. So it's really not surprising that he had had the two women over at his home that evening. But as police began investigating the case, they were thrown a number of false leads prior to being able to identify the killers. One of which is that Butch's car had been found earlier that morning, over 70 miles away in the small town of Belgrade. The car was a black Mercedes, had been set on fire, and sheriff's deputies actually found it and were able to trace the car back to Butch. Now, apparently, a Miramar police officer had arrived at the house prior to discovering the bodies, only to receive no response when the police officer knocked on the door. Looking into the background of the two women that had been found slain in the house yielded no clues either. The two women were Sharon L. Anderson and her friend Marie Rogers, and both of the women were 25 years old and known as being street smart, strong-headed young women. And I've seen a couple of different articles about this case that listed them both as dancers, while a few others did not give an occupation for them beyond that Anderson was an aspiring model. In any case, the two women were pretty much best friends and hung out together constantly and would frequent the clubs and bars in the area together, turning heads as they did so. One humorous little thing that I found concerned Marie Rogers' mother in a newspaper article, exclaiming after the murders as to how she could not understand how both women got to Casey's home. And given what I've already discussed with Casey's penchant for, women and drugs, it's pretty obvious that the reason that they were at the house was to party and eventually hook up with Casey. One of the first big breaks they got in the case happened to be when the friends of Casey divulged to police that he had become very paranoid and completely unlike himself in the weeks leading up to his death. In fact, a number of people informed the police that Casey seemed to think that he was in imminent danger and spoke a lot about machine guns and violence. And given the nature of his work owning the nightclub, as well as the prevalence of heavy narcotics in that area in that time, it makes me wonder if Casey had not possibly been involved in the drug trade to some extent, which may have explained, you know, his paranoia of, you know, and talk about violence as maybe something happened and he suspected that, you know, there might be some form of violent retribution. Another thing that may have contributed to the paranoia and anxiety that Casey was experiencing at the time was the amount of cocaine that he was ingesting as well as his usage. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a whole lot of data on that. Beyond the fact that he did, but it is known that heavy cocaine users become paranoid, depressive, anxious after prolonged use. But that's not the story that Butch Casey gave to his friends. He said that the reason that he was anxious and depressed actually came from the fact that one of his longtime friends was on trial for murder. And being as it's 1994, there's really only one case anyone thinks about when it comes to murder, and that was the trial of O.J. Simpson. Apparently, Casey and O.J. were friends dating back to Casey's time running the bar in Buffalo for his parents. And apparently, Butch's connection to O.J. leaked to the media not long after Butch's murder, and details began to emerge wherein OJ was arrested on June 12th, and a week later Butch was dead in his home. Naturally, when the media leaked this information, people in Miramar began speculating that possibly there was a mob connection to the entire thing, and that Butch had been killed because he knew something about the murders that OJ was accused of. They got their first real break in the case beyond the video when a witness emerged, a guy by the name of Gary Foy, who was a neighbor of Butch's, and when he came forward to the police, he informed them that he was on his way to a bowling tournament that day when he saw Butch's Mercedes pulling out of the driveway being driven by two young men, and he stopped to let them out. And according to Foy, he found it odd that Butch would let two men drive his vehicle and that the men were treating it like a new toy, opening the windows, the sunroof, playing with all the gadgets on the Mercedes as though they had never been in one before. Interspaced with this, however, was the revelation that the police discovered that Butch owed $50,000 to an organized crime family, and that the debt was real enough that Butch had been beaten and threatened by members of this family in order to get him to pay up. Further adding fuel to this fire was the discovery by police that Butch also recorded all of his phone conversations, in one of which he spoke with his adult son, Brian, who had only known Butch for about 10 years, as he was the result of a high school fling that Butch had And because of the revelations on these tapes, the police began to suspect, albeit briefly, that Brian might have been involved in Butch's death, as in one conversation, in fact, the last one they ever had, Butch informed his son that competition was really getting heated in the area, and that he had, quote-unquote, been forced to take care of one guy. Butch also went on to let his son know that if anything were to happen to him, he would be taken care of in the will, which naturally made police suspect that maybe Brian was involved in the murder. So, while the police are running down all of these false leads, trying to find, you know, the killers or a motive behind the killers, they've got these photographs out of the one suspect who had removed his mask and whose face they had been able to somewhat get and send out to different police agents. And they got their first real big break in the case about 3 weeks after the murder, when police in Miami-Dade County contacted them and informed them that they had 3 suspects in custody after a brutal home invasion, and that one of the suspects resembled the photograph that they had sent out. A detective from Miramar, Roy Black, went to the police station down in Miami-Dade County to interview the suspects, and apparently he encountered one of them in the hall and immediately recognized the man from the videotape. Now, according to one of the detectives who interrogated the man they had in custody, when shown the blurry image of his face and asked where they got this photograph of him, the suspect laid his head down on the table. And the suspect in custody's name was Pablo Ibar. And the reason he was in custody was that he and 2 other accomplices had broken into a home and assaulted the family demanding money, at one point threatening one of the residents of the home's unborn child with death before killing the family dog. Apparently, in that home invasion, someone had been able to hide in one of the bathrooms and call the police, after which time the suspects fled the house. And along with Ibar, he had a man by the name of Alex Hernandez and Alberto Rincon. Police eventually arrested all 3 of them hiding in the neighborhood. After they interrogated Ibar for a short period of time, they began looking for evidence to connect him to the murders in Miramar. One thing that they had that the killer did not know was they had bloody shoe prints from inside Casey's home, and they took Ibar's shoes to match them up to the shoe print, as well as his 2 accomplices' shoes, along with photographs of the 3 men to show to Foy, who, if you'll remember, was Casey's neighbor who had actually seen the killers leaving the house. And it's interesting to note that Foy narrowed the 3 suspects down to only Ibar and later picked him out of a lineup as one of the men he had seen inside the vehicle. They got another break in the case when the shoes worn by Alberto Rincon were found to match the bloody shoe prints found inside of Casey's home. And Rincon, when questioned about this, claimed he had borrowed the shoes from Pablo Ibar. Another piece of evidence that they discovered was a shirt that had been lying outside the door to Casey's home that had a logo on it. It said Consolidated Electrical Supply, And the reason this was important to the case was that the company had a business relationship with Pablo Ibar's mother's employer. And it was at this point that the case really started rolling, because detectives, now that they have suspects in custody, began looking around at the people these suspects knew, particularly the associates of Ibar. And one of these individuals that they questioned, who was a friend of Ibar's, named John Klizmenscheko, gave the police information that would eventually lead pretty much to the conclusion of this case. First, John, I'm not even going to attempt to butcher his name again, positively identified Ibar as being the man seen in the surveillance footage taken inside Casey's home. However, he then identified the other man in the house, telling police that the man was named Seth Penelover. It was after this that police learned that John had lived with both Ibar and Seth in a house on Lee Street in Hollywood, Florida, and police shifted the focus of their investigation to this house for a period of time. And they learned a few things from John, can't say his last name, that were important to the case. Firstly, he confirmed that people within the house would share clothing with one another if it fit the other person, thus giving credence to Alberto Rincon's claim that the shoes he was wearing actually belonged to Ibar. He further went on to detail that both Ibar and Penelover were acting strange that morning at the house, that morning being the morning of the murders. They had come home, quote-unquote, acting real funny and stuff, before expanding on that and saying that he had witnessed the two men remove a Tech-9 machine gun from underneath one of the beds in the house and leave with it. He also said that when they returned later that day, they were driving a new, darker-colored car. Now, all of this was excellent information for the case. However, John gave them one piece of information that would later cause problems for the prosecution, as he spelled Seth Penelover's name as Penlover, going so far as to spell it out in that fashion in his statement to the police, which for a short period of time led police to look for a man who did not actually exist. Eventually, they were able to recognize this mistake and put out the correct information, letting it be known that Seth Penelover was a person of interest in the Casey's Nickelodeon murders. And this was all over the news, on the television, so much so that Penelover eventually turned himself into police on August 5th of 1954. Further damning the two men's case was the fact that a woman named Melissa Monroe, who was Seth's girlfriend, told the police that the man in the security video looked like her boyfriend. She also told them that she and friends had run into Penelover and Ibar at Casey's Nickelodeon on the same night that the murders had taken place. The prosecution believed they had more than enough evidence to convict both men, and as such, the trial started on August 31st of 1994. However, there were a few kinks in the road. First and foremost, there was no physical evidence as far as DNA to place either men inside of the home. Also further hampering the prosecution, witnesses started changing their stories. John can't pronounce his name, came out and said on the stand that he had no recollection of ever giving the police any statements. This despite asserting that the voice on the recordings that were played in the courtroom did in fact belong to him. One of the biggest things to hamper the prosecution, however, was the prosecutors decided not to bring up the story of the home invasion that took place in Miami-Dade out of fear that the defendants would later use it as a means to appeal their case. As such, the jury ended up deadlocked when the trial was concluded and it had been given to them to decide the two men's fate. So what ended up happening was the men were retried again, this time separately. And the first retrial of Penelover in 1999, he was convicted of the murders and sentenced to death. This was in turn overturned when Penelover's defense attorneys argued that the state did not have a strong enough case against him. And this is one of the reasons why this case is one of the most famous in Southern Florida, because there has been such a long and protracted legal battle concerning it. Penelover went back to trial again in 2012. This time with the defense for Penelover claiming that it was Ibar himself who had committed the murders and that Penelover did not commit them, which caused a split, a schism between the two men. One of the tactics that Penelover's attorneys used was that Penelover had in fact gone through all of the court documents and police records while he was fighting his case, and in it he discovered that Alex Hernandez was a suspect, despite the police never admitting this publicly. Another major break for Penelover was a man by the name of Johnny McGill, who contacted police and informed them that he was the one who had driven Butch Casey's Mercedes away from the house and then set it on fire. This McGill character claimed that he did it on orders of his boss, although he never clarified on that. And after giving this statement, Johnny McGill walked out of the sheriff's office without giving any other information or being detained. Unfortunately, McGill ended up being shot to death the day after giving this statement outside of a Miami nightclub. Further, he found out that initially the way his name came to the attention of police was through Crime Stoppers. That's that, you know, the number they always give when there's a big case and they're trying to find a suspect. Well, the individual who had called in and was eventually given the reward for information leading to arrests identified the person in the ball cap in the video as Seth Penelover. And as we all know, John can't pronounce his last name is the only person to have ever used that name for Seth. And because of this, because John had been discredited on the witness stand, Seth was eventually acquitted and set free. Pablo Ibar, however, was not so lucky. he was able to get his death penalty overturned in 2016 when the Supreme Court of Florida ruled that he had received ineffective legal counsel and that the evidence was scarce and weak. One thing that came out, and there are some different websites that give other information on this, particularly the Mexican version of Wikipedia, which I actually had to translate in order to get some information on this case. A shirt had been found at Casey's home containing DNA from Mary Anderson and an unidentified individual, and Ibar's claim was that it did not match him, so his defense was able to have it retested, and he was claiming it came from another person. Unfortunately for Ibar, they found partial matches to his DNA in the DNA that had been found on the shirt. And the state decided they wanted, you know, a more complete DNA identification on this. So they had it retested again. And what they found, and I'm taking this from another website called CybGen, was that the DNA on the shirt was 353 trillion times more probable to belong to Pablo Ibar than it was to belong to anyone else. And what happened because of this? On January 19th, 2019, after years of legal wranglings and being put on death row and then having the conviction overturned, is that Pablo Ibar was found guilty once again of the triple homicide, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. This case actually has some kind of worldwide implications, because apparently Ibar's father is some form of celebrity, a soccer star in his native Spain, and because of this, there is strong sentiment in Spain that Ibar has been railroaded and is in fact not guilty. The sentiment is so strong that when he was initially convicted in 2000 and sentenced to death, the country of Spain actually granted Ibar citizenship, and they did this as a way to try and get the conviction nullified and thrown out of court, which obviously did not work. Well, that is it for the Deathcast this week. It's a little bit of a different case this week. As I said, it was recommended to me by a friend of mine, Howard Baum, who actually lives down in that area of Florida. Not our typical case. This one was solved pretty quickly, but the legal wrangling after the fact was pretty interesting. So I hope you enjoyed that, and if you didn't, well, I will be back next week with another case, provided I don't have any more serious issues with my computer. Until next week, stay safe and stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deathcast.